Well, we cover a lot of subjects on this program, don't we? Some are paranormal, scary, demonic, alternative medicine and health. You just heard us talking about a fair tax program and space and space exploration. And in a moment, Chris Impey back on Coast to Coast will talk about his latest work, Beyond Our Future in Space. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Chris Impey is a University of Distinguished Professor in the Astronomy Department, the University of Arizona in Tucson. His research interests center in cosmology, gravitational lensing, evolution, and structures of the galaxy. He is a past vice president of the American Astronomical Society. He has been on the Executive Council of the Astronomy Education Board. He's into all things science, and his latest book is called Beyond Our Future in Space. Chris, exciting times ahead. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's great to be back on your show, George.
So scientists have said that they have perused, I don't know how they did this, 100,000 galaxies, and they said that we really can't see anything that would give us the impression that there's intelligent life out there. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a sort of needle in a haystack. I think they're not convinced it doesn't exist. It's just probably rare, or we're just not looking in the right way.
Be kind of sad to think that we're the only ones out here.
Well, I guess it would put an obligation on us to do some smart things, wouldn't it?
It sure would be. And I'm sure you've been following the SpaceX in the rocket launch, in the attempted landing to keep this launcher going. It, of course, fell and didn't make it. That's going to be a tough project, isn't it?
Yeah, that's, if you're talking about diving or gymnastics, very high degree of difficulty. And it's interesting that Elon Musk is not deterred by three failures in a row. He thinks they're just getting closer to doing it. And, of course, when he gets his fully reusable launch vehicle, he's going to lower the cost of getting into orbit by a significant factor.
Yeah, the problem with what I see, Chris, is it just seems to be so iffy. If the weather's not right, it's not going to work. It's going to be tough, I think.
Yeah, and it's always been that way. I mean, you can remember back how many shuttle launches were scrubbed, and, it's always been that way.
Chris, your latest work, Beyond Our Future in Space, let's talk a little bit about this. You've been in astronomy. I would guess that even when you were a little boy, you loved things in space, didn't you?
Yeah, although I did grow up in the UK where, we don't have a lot of stars and it's a pretty cloudy place. So I had to leave and come to this country in Arizona to get some really good dark skies.
Oh, and you get some great ones, don't you?
Yep.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your work and our ability to leave this planet one day. Tell us about what is our future? It's changing so fast.
Yeah, and I think people get caught up in the fact that it's difficult to get into space, which is always going to be true, and that, we kind of seem to be in the doldrums, especially with NASA not able to get an American into orbit. Now it's been a couple of years. The shuttle retired. The space station, kind of an unloved project to most scientists, and sort of seems like we're kind of stuck. But this private space enterprise, which is really just starting, it's almost too early to judge it, is really going to boom. I think it's going to, hopefully not in a bad way, and take off and grow. And then I think even NASA and the government agencies elsewhere in Europe and Japan and so on are going to, get some new successes under their belt. And part of it is due to miniaturization. We're sort of leveraging these great technologies that go into our cell phones and do amazing things, and we can actually put small things into space a lot more cheaply than these big rockets.
Oh, gosh, I remember during those old Soviet days of launching. Those things were so huge, weren't they?
And they still get used. Orbital Sciences, which had a big rocket blow up back late last year, those are basically Russian Proton rockets that date back from the early 60s. That's a 50-year-old technology, and the Russians still use it. And it's a pretty reliable rocket, actually. It's been getting cosmonauts to the space station pretty reliably for a decade or more.
Well, that's true, too. But when you talk about miniaturization for space, are we also going to find ways, they were talking about an engine that may get astronauts to Mars in 39 days. I mean, that's absolutely staggering. If they're talking about that now, what's it going to be like 100 years from now?
Yeah, I agree. It's very hard to project that far ahead. I mean,
For
me, the crystal ball is cloudy 10 or 15 years out. I could sort of predict that long. 100 years, I couldn't. Getting to Mars in a month or so would be amazing, because at the moment it's going to be an 8 to 10 month trip, and pretty hazardous one. And those rockets, those new technologies, you know, they're not really tried and tested on human space capsules and human flight. They're still being worked out in the lab and in miniature versions, but there's no reasons they shouldn't work when they scale up.
What's your opinion of our current space program right now?
I think it's a mixed bag, because we're obviously, NASA at least, is sort of kind of stuck without a heavy launch capability, so it's had ups and downs, and some of it's political. You know, the priorities change every election cycle, and it's hard for them to get a long-term plan out there. But they're doing their space launch system, and that, within 5 years, is going to lead to ability to get into orbit more mass or more weight than even Apollo did. So that, and it's a pretty powerful rocket that they're building, the Orion capsule. So NASA's, you know, had its problems, but they're working on a pretty good launch capability. And that, of course, it's more launch capability than any of these private companies are able to do right now. So, and NASA's also partnering with some of the space companies. It's not really just a competition of them versus the private sector. There's a lot of collaboration. NASA's dishing out seed money to some very nimble little startups to try, for instance, these different propulsion technologies. So that's a positive thing, that there are a lot of new players coming into the space business.
What is the reason for privatization? I mean, because NASA's spending Peter to pay Paul, and granted, those prices are going to come down. I could never figure out why NASA never got their prices down. But what do you think the reason is for getting private companies involved?
I think they're just more nimble. You know, having the profit motive, having investors to satisfy, means their motivation to keep costs down and to innovate is much stronger. And what you said is true. NASA never sort of really had a strong incentive to keep costs down. For instance, most of the first half of the shuttle launches were, until the military got their own launch capability, were used by the military. And, you know, they would just pay whatever it cost. And so the shuttle was a really expensive way to get stuff into orbit. Elon Musk is, of course, you know, working on the rocket equation and just trying to make everything very efficient, very low mass, low weight if possible. And he's, you know, working down that price per kilo or price per pound to Earth orbit by a factor of maybe 5 or 6 lower than it is now. And that's sort of a game changer, because then new people can get into the game, then universities, and there are even student groups launching these CubeSats, these little 10-centimeter Rubik's Cube-sized satellites, which was never the case. A decade ago, satellites were huge and expensive, too. So the miniaturization thing is also leveling the playing field.
Do you ever see the day that NASA's going to get out of the game entirely?
I don't think so. Their charter from when they started in 1959 was a peaceful charter. It was founded in, you know, out of the Cold War as a statement that the U.S. was going to do peaceful exploration of space, and they've always been doing that. They've been launching, you know, missions within the solar system and space telescopes for decades, and their plans continue for doing that in the future. So I don't see that changing. That's their charter, and I think Congress is happy for them to do that. So that seems like a good mission for them.
What I found puzzling, Chris, is, you know, by mandate, the vice president's supposed to be in charge of NASA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, LBJ seemed to be involved a lot when he was there. And then Hubert Humphrey when, you know, he was the vice president for LBJ. But by and large, I mean, like Biden and people like that, where are they with NASA? I don't see them doing anything.
Right. They're not the political leadership, except for a couple of key players in Congress who head the appropriations committees that deal with space, who are very interested. You're right, the senior political figures have really not cared too much about NASA. They've not treated it as a high priority. And that's part of why NASA's sort of, you know, been in limbo. And their budget, of course, is flatlined, which means in real terms it's sort of declining slowly. So, yeah, NASA has a hard job doing clever and big new things with the budget they have, which is why these constraints don't apply to the commercial sector as long as they can eventually generate revenue, whether it's for by tourism or just for shipping the freight up to Earth orbit.
Chris, are you happy with our robotic program?
I think it's great because we've always known, and most of the scientists and astronomers just think you get way more bang for your buck out of robots. You don't have to care for them and feed them and, you know, protect them from the harsh environment of space. And the miniaturization that we see all around us in commercial and consumer electronics, you know, is a huge benefit when you're working in space. So it's been very exciting. NASA's actually been maybe a little slow to jump on the miniaturization wagon, but even they are now, like with this example I said of the CubeSats, these little miniaturized packages that can pack a satellite's worth of electronics into a tiny volume and then bundle a bunch of them to do different things and put them into orbit. So people are doing that, and I think that's going to continue. That's going to get bigger. That's where the innovation really is to me, and is at the small end of things.
Well, we've got more computer power in our smartphones than the lunar landers had in the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. And your smartphones also can have all these sensors attached to them now, not just the accelerometers and the GPS that we're familiar with, but also other kinds of sensors. People are using their smartphones to do citizen science, you know, to make measurements of climate and atmospheric constituents and various things. And you can put those things into orbit and do Earth looking science. And so there's some very clever projects now that essentially are putting large numbers of miniature satellites up there that really use just cell phone technologies and sensors to do Earth looking science. And by extension, eventually you could use those and attach little solar sails to them and send them off into the solar system to look at solar system objects.
Well, with the professor of astronomy, Chris Impey, as we talk about beyond our future in space, you've talked about, Chris, how you think within 30 years, we'll have some small colonies on the moon and Mars. That could even be sooner, couldn't it?
It could be, although I'm not sure I believe the Mars One projections. They're very optimistic and aggressive, and a lot of the experts and engineers I talk to who know more about this than I do are dubious that Mars One, that private enterprise out of the Netherlands, can really do what they claim they're going to do in little more than a decade. But in 20 or 30 years, then yes, I think it'll happen, and it could, and NASA could do it within that time frame. The Chinese could do it within that time frame, which is a very interesting topic, how the Chinese are progressing in their space program. So one way or the other, whether it's the private sector or NASA or one of our international rivals, I think it will happen.
And you think within 100 years, even more dramatic, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, we could explore our backyard, but at some point when you've got to leave home. And so for us, leaving home will mean leaving the solar system. And that's a huge stretch goal, because the distance
sure
to the stars is hundreds of thousands of times the distance to the nearest planet. And so that's a huge adventure and extremely difficult. It's really beyond our current capabilities. So I guess it's pretty safe for me to play out a 100-year prediction, since I'm not going to be around to be proved wrong.
Chris, when I was 19, we landed on the moon, and subsequently before that, you know, I was a witness to Alan Shepard going into space, John Glenn making his orbit, the tragedy of Apollo 1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was there during all of this incredible time in space, and there was a difference because, I mean, I remember kids my age then, we all wanted to be astronauts. You know, we wanted to get involved in the space program. We had this excitement about space. That's gone today. I don't think I have seen or heard from one youngster who says, oh, I can't wait to be an astronaut. We all would say that in our days, but it doesn't happen anymore. How come?
You're right. I think people have got different interests now. You know, there's clearly a large fraction of young people or people in general who are caring more about what's going on with our planet than what's going on in space. And so the attention is sort of turning inward a little, and they think we've got enough problems to deal with right here. But, you know, I teach big classes of 18, 19-year-olds, and I'm teaching 150 right now. And I poll them, actually, using, you know, clickers, audience response devices, so I can do little economic models, what they would spend, say, for a three-day vacation in space, and I can run an economic model. And you're right, it's not a pervasive. It's not the way the fervor that was created by the Apollo landings. But I'd say about 10%, you know, of that cohort, the millennials, those teenagers, 20-year-olds, are definitely interested. You know, there's pretty significant apathy amongst a large rest. So it's a smaller fraction, but the fervor, once you talk to those, that fraction, say 10%, is still substantial. And even if it's only 5 or 10% of the overall population, that's millions of people who are interested in this, who would sign up for a trip, who might invest in it, who might do space tourism. It's a significant market.
Some are signing up for a one-way trip to Mars. Is that pretty gallant, or is that the stupidity?
Well, you know, it's their choice. And Mars One, I apparently have exaggerated those numbers a little. It was touted to be over 100,000, but maybe not quite that many. And that's striking. However many, it's pretty striking that tens of thousands of people would, many of them quite young, would sign up for a one-way ticket to Mars, knowing they would die there. So that's striking. I'm not sure what it says, but it says that some fraction of people are willing to do that adventure at the cost of their lives, not just for a trip and then come back. I mean, it's going to be a more viable business when it's a colony with a small number of people there, and people go and come back, and we sort of just establish a toehold on another planet and learn how to live there.
I get antsy after a couple days at some lake house. Can you imagine being on another planet or the moon, where you got to wear, you know, a space suit when you go out?
Oh, you got to like the people you're with. You're going to be
You're stuck with them.
Pretty close quarters, and you are for sure stuck with them for quite a while.
Oh, my God. And what if things go wrong? Jealousies, passions get out of control.
Well,
everything,
of course,
huh?
That's why it's interesting in the Mars One example, where they were trying to fund it by doing a reality TV show based on, you know, the whole adventure of going there. And I'm sure the drama and tension that would play out among the small number of colonists.
Whatever happened to that idea to do that
well,
show?
Well, it's still in play, and they, you know, they've backed off their dates to be late in the 20s now, so they're backing off to 10 or 12 years from now. But they haven't, you know, they're still claiming they're going to do it. They're going to start sending, you know, pairs or two or colonists at a time, starting in, say, 2024, 2026, and then resupply every couple of years, every time Mars has a close approach to the Earth, basically. So, you know, if you go to their website and see their press releases, they still claim they're going to do it. There's some skepticism, technically, that they can do it, but, you know, it's still out there as a plan.
What are, in your opinion, Chris, a couple of the most exciting things going on right now for space technology or exploration?
Well, I think, one thing that it's almost old school is the resuscitation of the idea of solar sails, which have had, you know, a few experiments, and that's, of course, a way of harnessing the sun's energy to move through the solar system. So solar sails coupled to some of these miniaturized technologies of satellites or just space probes to go to Mars or beyond, that's an exciting avenue, and it really has legs. I mean, I think when you've miniaturized some of these probes and attached solar sails that we know how to build, you've got a very cheap propulsion mechanism. You're not sending people, so solar sails are kind of very gentle, slow push from the sun, so the acceleration is quite modest. But, of course, it keeps building and building, and it can get you to a high speed. So that's an exciting thing. And then I think another thing is almost out of science fiction, but it actually is plausible now, is the space elevator idea.
Let's talk more about that, Chris, when we come back. We're going to hit this break. Well, with Chris Impey, his work Beyond Our Future in Space, his website, of course, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be right back just like that. Well, you spacefaring folks, next hour we'll take phone calls with Chris Impey as we talk about his work Beyond Our Future in Space. Hey, by the way, need a little of your help. My affiliate here in Los Angeles, KFI AM 640, along with the Red Cross and the California Earthquake Authority, are putting on a benefit to raise 100% of these proceeds going to disaster preparedness. And they are auctioning off dinner with everybody at KFI, including me, of course. We're going to have dinner at Morton's in Burbank on a future date. If you would go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, you will see the story right under the highlights section. Click that. It'll take you to the KFI Red Cross website. And bid for me. Last year, $1,500 was bid for me, and we had a great time. So go ahead and do it. And those of you who bid last year, if you want to do it again, go right ahead. We'll be back in a moment. We're back. Chris Impey with us, of course, Beyond Our Future in Space. And I noticed that it's already out on the bookstores and Amazon has it, Chris.
Yeah, I think the pub date was Monday, actually, so it's just out.
Good timing, indeed. You enjoy this. You've got a lot of books out there.
I know. I'm busy. You know, when I'm not doing my day job teaching at the university and doing research, you know, I get up at 5 in the morning. You know, I'm a night owl. Not maybe as night owl as you are, but that's when I do my writing.
You know, you said you had about 150 students in your class.
Mm-hmm.
Are you bullish? Are you hopeful for the future of our country with young people and science?
Yes, I am. I might not have said that so much 5 or 10 years ago, but at the University of Arizona and other big universities, we're seeing a surge in the number of students enrolling in science, engineering, and math. It's growing faster almost than any other subject. 10 or 15, 20 years ago, most students were declaring business or finance majors or psychology or sociology, those kind of big degree programs. But we can barely handle the increase in the number of STEM majors. And a lot of them are in life sciences, actually. That's the biggest growth area.
You're talking about the space elevator. We've talked a little bit about it on this show before, Chris. But let's refresh everybody's minds on just what it is and how realistic it might be.
Right. So a space elevator, it is a pretty much science fictional concept that dates back. It actually dates back, the history is interesting because it dates back to Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, who is, you know, the Russian visionary over a century ago who gave us the rocket equation. And he was watching the Eiffel Tower being built in Paris, and he just imagined what would happen if you kept building that tower higher and higher. Couldn't you get to a place where putting something in orbit was as trivial as just letting it go? Well, you can't do it with a tower like that, but the concept now is to take a cable made of some super strong and slender material, some carbon nanotube composite, and you just float that cable or run that cable up into the sky to the point where it reaches where a geostationary orbit would be. And at that point, the centrifugal force, you know, of the spinning Earth and the weight of the cable are in perfect balance, and the thing will just hang there, sort of like an Indian rope trick. But you're talking about way up there. We're talking about 100,000 miles into the air if it's an Earth space elevator.
And what are the possibilities, you know, of some plane smashing into the cable or something?
Right. So there's a ton of practical problems. But the big one for an Earth-based space elevator is that we just don't have a material to make a cable that long, strong enough to go up into the sky. The interesting thing, though, is that our materials have got good enough that we could do it on the moon, because the 1/6 gravity of the moon means our materials are actually good enough to build a lunar space elevator. And that doesn't sound as interesting because we're not on the moon doing anything. But if we want to use the moon as a staging point for travel through the solar system, then, and we had a moon base where we could just mine the moon or lunar soil for oxygen to make rocket fuel and to breathe and have a little habitat and a moon base. And if we had a space elevator, then traveling through the solar system would get really cheap. The point being that when you have a space elevator, you just have little climbing devices going up and down, and you don't have to burn rocket fuel, and you just avoid all the huge costs of rocketry.
What would the weight of payloads be for something like this?
Not huge. I mean, the elevator, you know, it could break, and as you point out, you know, things could run into it. You'd worry about terrorism. You'd worry about meteorite impacts. You'd worry about all sorts of things. Actually, one of the things the engineers worry the most about is instabilities in the cable, you know, oscillations, if you like, that get uncontrollable and sort of rip it apart. That's actually the thing the engineers worry about. They don't actually worry about building it once they have the right material, but they worry about secondary things. So we could do it on the moon. At the cost, who knows, but numbers I've read from you know, reasonably well-based engineering studies suggest $5 to $10 billion to do one on the moon, and hopefully generating an economic activity that would dwarf that number.
How long would it take to go up the elevator?
And to go up the elevator, that's related to what I was saying about instability. You actually can't go up too fast, or you create oscillations and vibrations.
Right.
So it, in an Earth lunar elevator, it actually might take a few days. It's a pretty gentle ride up into orbit, nothing like, you know.
Would it be like an elevator in a high rise, or slower or faster?
It's similar, or maybe even slower. So it's a pretty leisurely way to go up, but you're mostly carrying freight, so you don't care. I mean, it's not really the tourists that are going to be doing this for the most part. You're just moving the freight. It's sort of just like having a moderately slow rail system that's moving around the country, but large masses, and so you don't care that it takes a week to get from Chicago to New York. Because
would the elevator be self-contained?
It would be self-contained, and of course, I think it would be expensive enough that it would be an international thing. You know, the countries would combine and collaborate and share the ownership of it. I doubt that it would be built by any commercial entity or by even a single government.
Why space, Chris?
Yeah, good question, and a legitimate question. The people who are committed to it have what I speculate in the book is the explorer gene, this DRD4 variant of a gene that is correlated with risk-taking behavior and migrations of early humans and so on. So some people have it, I think, built into their DNA. But for most people, it's a legitimate question. I think it's the next frontier. We'll go into space to learn how to live in difficult environments, maybe how to live better on the Earth, because the Earth is going to become a challenging environment possibly in the future. So we'll learn some lessons about living in space, about how to be very efficient in our use of resources, how to, you know, grow food very efficiently, how to get water out of rocks, which is what you would have to do if you live on the moon or Mars. So some of those technologies in the extreme environment of space actually do have some potential to benefit us on the Earth.
What concerns you about space or our mission?
I mean, one thing, without getting scaremongering about it, I mean, one thing that concerns me a little bit is the very muscular Chinese space program, which could lead them to have their own space station at a time when ours is deorbited and fallen into the ocean, burned up in the atmosphere, and they could indeed get to the moon or Mars before we do. And so related to that is the issue of the militarization of space. There's Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which essentially bans the militarization of space and says nobody can own these things. It actually doesn't say nobody can own it. It says no government can own the moon or Mars, but it doesn't rule out personal ownership. But these things, this treaty has sort of been really untested and maybe unenforceable. So that's, you know, not anything people should be super worried about, but it's there as a concern.
I'm concerned that China has some kind of a plan to develop enough technology, and they may already have it, to take out our satellites.
Right, and they got, serious flak, legitimate flak for, you know, destroying one of their own satellites and creating, you know, a huge amount of space debris. Which does a disservice to everyone. I mean, that was an extremely antisocial thing to do. So, yes, those technologies exist, and that's a real concern. So, we witnessed, and you were talking earlier about the great space race of the 1960s, which had its inspirational moments, of course, with the moon landings, but that was a big geopolitical pissing contest with the Russians, mostly, and we won that. I mean, the Russian space program is now a shadow of its former self, but the Chinese are building their space program at the rate their economy is growing, which is 6, 8, or 10% a year, and ours is not doing much at all. It's flatlined, and that makes a big play that out over a decade, and you've got a big gain from the Chinese in what they can do.
And they're doing it with 2015 technology, Chris. I mean, when I look back in the 60s, and it was just Russia and the United States, partly because of the German knowledge that we got during Project Paperclip. I mean, it took decades for anybody to even get close to what we did. I mean, here we are, 2015. We landed on the moon in 1969. So, you know, 46 years. Nobody has been able to do that except us. I mean, for us to be 46 years ahead of any other country, mm-hmm. and still nobody's been able to, you know, keep track. We gave up that momentum, didn't we?
Right. It's like that Jurassic Park scene. The objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear. So, you know, the Chinese are coming up from a small space in the space game, but very fast. And I think for a while, people reassured themselves by thinking, well, you know, they're just copying our old technology and not innovating. But they are innovating now. They're training really good engineers and scientists. They're doing original designs. They're developing their own new technologies. They're very proud of that. So they're a legitimate force in space. There's no question. And their plans, I don't know what their secret plans might be, but their plans in plain view include a base on the moon, include visiting Mars, include their own space station, include very high levels of activity of sending taikonauts up to get used to living in space and zero gravity. And, you know, that's something, none of those things are really on the agenda for NASA in the next decade or so.
What do you think of the possibility that mankind is so much older than they say, and that we have had intelligent civilizations in the past that have been destroyed for whatever reason, but that we had the kind of technology, that we did get to the moon, that, you know, we did travel to Mars, but we may have done it 10 million years ago. Possible?
I don't know. I mean, I'm a skeptic just because I would want to see the residue of that technology. So we look for our ancestors and dig up bones and carbon date them and try and trace our lineage back through pre-humans. And, you know, I'm waiting to see a technology attached to those bones or those sites that indicates we really had some extraordinary capability. And I haven't seen it yet. I mean, I'll keep an open mind. It will be an intriguing idea. And I kind of like the idea. It's salutary to just know that we don't always march forward. You know, you can, if you mess things up, you can go backwards. You know, you can, just like Europe went into a dark ages after the glorious times of the Greeks and all the insights they had and some pretty interesting technologies they had. You can go backwards if you mess things up with a civilization.
Are you convinced that we are or are not alone in the universe?
Well, it's got to be evidence-based for me, but the numbers are pretty compelling to me that we're not alone. So the Kepler satellite has found enough Earth-like worlds within a few hundred light years to pretty confidently project the number of Earth-like habitable planets in just the Milky Way, and it's 20 billion. That's an amazing number.
It's huge.
And so that is the number of places where all the ingredients for biology exist, you know, water, carbon.
Basically. And the soup's the same, isn't it? The primordial soup's
the same. The chemical ingredients are the same. The water is a pretty commonly available ingredient, and there'll be watery worlds. Those are an energy source. So these are just, you know, billions of proto-Earths, and also in existence billions of years before the Earth formed. So we're talking about, you know, biological experiments that had a huge head start on us.
That's right.
So
exactly.
Huge numbers in the real estate is both time and space. And so for me, yes, it's extremely unlikely that this is the only biological experiment in the galaxy, let alone the universe.
If you believe in the panspermia theory, that we were seeded by comets or asteroids, mm-hmm. Then you have to believe that that's happened elsewhere, and that this, like you would toss a tomato seed wherever you want, you're going to get a tomato that grows from it. I think that's the same with us, and I think that seed is out there. It's maturing in an environment that might be like Earth. It's got some water. It's got the right distance from its star. I think the same thing's going to happen.
Yeah, and I guess the big question with that as a likelihood, and I agree with you, is it the same? You know, does biology develop the same way in these other similar physical environments? Or does it have to look like us? Does it have to be based on DNA? Does it have to have cells? And, the, you know, we'd love to know the answer to that question. It's exciting either way. If we find out that we are the template for life, that life in the universe exists and it's just like us, or the basis microscopically is like ours, that would be kind of amazing. And if it was totally different, that would be amazing too, because it would mean we're just one brand of biology and there are all these other brands out there that are totally different.
Yeah, I just tend to think that, you know, one, do you need calamities that, let's say, wiped out the dinosaurs in order to make room for us? But I just think that, and let's take religion out of it for a moment, I think that whatever has happened on this planet in terms of its 4.5 billion years is going to be the same on every other planet that happens to have the same kind of environment we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the chemical ingredients. You know, the toolkit is the same. I agree.
The same.
And that's, we pretty much demonstrated that in astronomy. So if the toolkit's the same, are the biological creatures the same? They might not look the same. You know, their shapes and sizes and internal organs and sensory apparatus might be a little different. But yeah, the architecture of the biological species specimens might be very similar.
Well, look at how similar but different we are as people on this planet.
Right. Of course, the interesting thing is that even if it were similar elsewhere, it doesn't mean there's a kinship or communication, because, you know, you could look at a chimpanzee and we share 99% of our DNA with a creature that we can't have a conversation with. So if you're talking about biology on another planet, the odds of communication seem to be quite small.
Now, I come back to the $64,000 question, and that is, of course, the mixture of intelligent design in there. Not necessarily some guy up there in the clouds that, you know, people call God. I don't think that's what it is. But there's got to be something that creates this intelligence. I mean, Chris, here we are. I'm talking to an astronomer who wrote a book called Beyond Our Future in Space. I'm in my studio in St. Louis doing this interview. We got to be more than atoms and molecules. Something has jump-started this, and I'll never, ever back down on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's something special about humans. I mean, we have sentience. We have the ability to understand our situation in the universe, and we seem to be the only creature on the planet, on our planet, that can do that. So, I mean, I'm not going to argue for the complete specialness of humans, but there's no question we have some extraordinary capability and situation, and it's a fair question to ask, you know, what's going on that led to that? You know, how did we end up so special? How did we end up as self-aware, intelligent creatures understanding our situation in the universe?
I mean, I was in New York about a year and a half ago, and, you know, you walk down Madison Avenue, and you're looking at all these guys in their suits and briefcases and all these women walking around. And, you know, doing their thing, everyone thinking about something, maybe dinner, or, you know, where they're going to go after work, whatever. And you look at that environment, Chris, and you have to come up with that conclusion that there's more here than this. This is not just a crapshoot and life just started. There's something going on. I can't figure it out yet.
Right.
But maybe we'll get to it.
And that puts the onus on finding life elsewhere, because, you know, making a context for our specialness will require us to know whether we're alone in the universe or not.
Chris, I want to talk with you about the Big Bang when we come back, and we'll take an hour of phone calls with you. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.